WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives, one moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. It's TV Week on Fresh Air, today featuring interviews with the creators and writers of variety and sketch comedy shows. The Smothers Brothers Comedy Hour ran from 1967 to 69. It featured guest performers, sketches, and the music and comedy of Tom and Dick Smothers. The show's topical humor and satire made it the target of network censors who frequently deleted sketches and songs. After several censorship battles, CBS fired the Smothers Brothers and discontinued the series in 1969. Eventually, the brothers got a couple of other shows, but they never caught on like the original did. The Smothers Brothers' early act coincided with the folk revival of the 1960s. They often spoofed the seriousness of folk music.
Many folk songs have been written in the first person, the original authentic folk songs. They have been written during the actual occurrence of a historic event by someone who was involved in this event. The song my brother would like to sing now was written in the first person by a man about 150 years ago. It's entitled Hangman.
Hangman, hangman, slack your rope. Hangman, hangman, slack your rope. Slack it for a...
short. We have another song, which is an old folk song, and it hasn't been sung enough lately, we feel. It's been sort of neglected, and it's a very nice song, and I know you'll recognize it the moment we start.
Jimmy crack corn and I don't care.
Jimmy crack corn and I don't care.
Jimmy
I
crack
don't
corn
care,
and Jimmy
crack...
Wait a minute. That's not the way the song goes.
I don't care. I just don't like that song.
Tom Smothers is the blonde-haired brother who's the guitarist and plays the dimwit. The straight man is Dick Smothers, the dark-haired brother who plays bass. I spoke with them in 1985. Tom told me how their music act evolved into satire.
I would go out there, and for some reason I would mimic people. And it would be, we were known as satirists. I didn't even know what the word was until they said the Smothers Brothers satirized the folk music craze. We're just out there. I'd hear someone sing a song, and they'd be deadly serious about it, and I couldn't help but just kind of poke a little fun at it.
And then to make fun in a lighthearted way and just have a really ridiculous story that has nothing to do with the music, like Tommy had...
Dark as a Dungeon?
Dark as a Dungeon. The most ludicrous would be, they call the wind Mariah. He says it's an old Jewish folk song, Machaya. And then Hava Nagila, where they danced around a hat. It was a rain dance. Actually, they danced around an umbrella, and they similar to how they danced around hats, the Mexicans, and prayed for hair. And you just the further, the bigger the lie, it just becomes funny.
What's your own ethnic background?
Ethnic?
We have none.
We don't even have a secret.
In search of a background.
We have no food, secret food, family food, handshakes. You know, we're not Jewish, Italian, name it. We're just wasps.
What were your alternatives? Did you have alternative plans if you didn't become performers?
I always wanted to be a comedian. When I first saw George Gobel, who was my first influence, when I was 12, 13, 14, he was doing the Ed Sullivan Show. I thought it was marvelous what this man did. And I'd like to do that. I told my principal. I said, that's what I'd like to do. And so I had a coping problem. I was pretty slow in school. And so I was genuinely trying to get my applause, not through scholastics, but through attention getting. If I was late for class, instead of walking in the back door and sliding into the seat, you know, I walked in the front door and apologized to the teacher and then to each of the students individually until I was sent to the principal's office, really deadpan. I knew I had this kind of a little bit of a gift to get people laughing.
The problem I would expect is if you play a jerk on stage, that off stage people might think that you're dim-witted. Did that ever happen to you, that people would assume, you know, off stage that
I was so close. I was so close to my on-stage, off-stage. There was just a very thin line between...
People would come up to you in a Purple Onion, the first job, and say, why, don't do this. This is so painful. If it's so upsetting to you, don't get on that stage.
Well, that's very good performance, because that's like being in crawling into the skin of of the whatever character you choose, and that was the only one I had. And I was walking down the street in the Purple Onion, and some guy says, could you tell me where the Black Cat Cafe is? I said, yeah, it's just down that one street and turn left. He says, I know where it is. I just want to see if you knew how to give directions. You're so stupid on stage.
What about you, Dick Smothers? Did your persona on stage as the just more practical, down-to-earth persona mm-hmm. apply to the role you really played in your relationship with your brother?
Yeah, I think so. That's the way I am in real life, just exaggerated. I think we exaggerate our natural tendencies when we get into comedy. And then it's believable. You know, if you create somebody who's not there, I think you have to be a superior actor to let anybody buy it. I'm pretty logical. Basically, if things don't make any sense to me, I don't want to do it. And that's the way I control our relationship on stage with Tommy. You know, he would go off on a tangent, and I would correct him.
We're listening to a 1985 interview with the Smothers Brothers. Here they are on stage.
None of the kids like me, and Dickie Smothers had a dog, and I had to play by myself in the backyard. He said, you got to have a dog, because Mom gave you a dog, and I didn't get a dog. I had
a chicken.
It's no fun playing with a chicken all the time. We didn't even bark. I said, bark, chicken, you better bark!
We'll hear more from the Smothers Brothers after a break. This is Fresh Air. It's TV Week on Fresh Air. Let's get back to our 1985 interview with Tom and Dick Smothers. You reached even wider audiences than you had just performing when you got on television as the hosts of your own hour variety show. How did CBS first approach you about that? What did they tell you that they wanted?
Well, a preface to that is that in 1961, we started doing the Jack Parr show, and then we did about 14 shows.
We had 13 the last 6 months Jack was on the air.
So we got a lot of guest spots. It was Bing Crosby and
Sarah. Ed Sullivan, I remember seeing you a lot on the Ed Sullivan
show.
That was
later on, Ed Sullivan. Gary Moore, we were...
So by the time we had our own series offered to us with CBS, we did a situation comedy that went 32 episodes, which was totally contrary to any of our experience because there was no audience there, and we had to repeat the lines.
It was shot as a film. You know, it wasn't three camera. It was a film.
And it was a very difficult, very trying time for us.
Awful.
And when CBS came to us half a season later, said, here's a variety show, I was so upset with the other show. We said, we want creative control. And they said, you got it. Well, they were sending us down the tubes anyway. They didn't expect us to make it.
The time slot was at opposite Bonanza. And Gary Moore just got canceled, and he was the last rated show in television. So they gave us the worst spot and then gave us everything that Tommy wanted. Because we weren't going to be around more than a few weeks anyway.
So what'd you ask for?
I asked for creative control. That meant the material, the control
content.
Of the writers, content, the look of the show, everything. And the fact that it really went well. We had a nice cast of people put together by the producers and everything, but it wasn't quite what we wanted, but it evolved, and I got younger writers, got Mason Williams, I'd bring him in. If a writer seemed like it was cliche and was bringing out old material, not creative new ideas, we'd replace him each 13-week period, until we had pretty much what I wanted. The times dictated awareness came about that time in the mid-60s when Vietnam, voter registration, Selma, all those things started coming through, and they started leaking into our minds, our own consciousness, and they started coming out a little bit in attitudes in the show. And our writers were young, and we kind of had this little kind of small group that worked late into the night. None of the other shows did. We'd leave at sometimes 1 o'clock, 12 o'clock at night from reworking sketches and stuff. And everybody had love beads on and sandals. It was we were a real product of the times. And we reflected that viewpoint that was not being
So then
heard.
Instantly, once it was a hit, it was a surprise hit. It really was. Nobody predicted it. CBS wanted us to pull back, didn't want any controversy in anything. They, not realizing the content of the show was in large part of its success. So that was a running battle for 72. I think we did 72 episodes. It was pretty much a running battle from day one. through the firing at the last.
Well, they actually censored, deleted some of the performance excerpts.
That was their legal right. And once they got it, they, I guess by the contracts and stuff, they could take out anything they wanted. But
how would that work? When would you have to deliver the show to them,
so to
speak?
Was another whole thing. It changed. It changed every year. We delivered the shows just a normal practice, but I think the way it was about a week.
A strike happened, a musician strike, so that put everything behind. And some of those things, so we were all of a sudden working, taping on a Friday, delivering for a Sunday show. That meant editing with a razor blade. And I, of course, being naive and not knowing anything about television, I involved myself in everything.
Well, wait a minute. Razor blade means that they did not have the electronic sophistication that they have now. So you actually physically took razor blades and cut tapes and put pieces together, and they worked straight through right after production.
Oh, yeah. Wait, great.
And then they gave it to a girl, and she flew to New York and handed them
these
tapes.
Yes, the New York tape.
And
so when they would say, we don't like this part here, we say, you must take that out, or we will take it out. I said, well, I'll take it out. And it did take a long time.
What would you
do it?
You'd have to put something back in to replace it.
No, if they wanted out, we presented our contractual obligation, which was to present a show of an hour's length or whatever it was minus the commercials. After that, they could take it out. They took things out and put in a Nixon commercial when it was political. Oh, yeah. Of course, I got furious.
What had they taken out to put in the Nixon commercial?
I don't remember.
I do. It was the whole Belafonte piece, Mama Look a Boo Boo. It was the 68 convention news footage from Chicago, the bloody riots and everything, and Belafonte sang some calypso numbers to news footage that had been seen on the air. Nothing offensive about it, except where you'd see Mayor Daley in the news footage at the convention, and the lyric might say "Look a boo boo," or something like that. It was light satire. They took the whole hunk out. It must have been 5 minutes or more.
No, seven.
7 minutes, and put in a huge Nixon thing, which was a little salt in the wound. But it was gamesmanship, I think, a little bit there.
It was hardball.
One of the most famous deleted portions of your program is Pete Seeger singing Waist Deep in the Big Muddy. Mm-hmm. He made his network comeback, really, on your show, didn't he?
Right. Pete Seeger was blackballed for a long time. And when the Hootenanny show was on the air, that was back in the early 60s, we didn't know anything about what this meant. We didn't know about censorship or there was any problem. And we're doing Hootenanny, and there were some kids out, college students, protesting, you know, picket line out there, because Pete Seeger wasn't on. We're wandering around. We don't know anything about it. And when we had our show, Pete Seeger, of course, is one of the classic people in the United States as far as folk music and his blues.
He's a troubadour. He's a very gentle troubadour.
So when we had an opportunity to put him on the air, we put him on the air, and everybody who was on our show, they were guests. They were considered guests. What would you like to do? What song? He said, I'd like to sing this song. I said, fine. This is too long. We only have this much time. He chose Waist Deep in the Big Muddy, and, well, it reflected our attitudes and our staff and our writing staff, and we said, sure, that's fine. And they said, no. So I said, feature our guest, feel free. He sang the song, and they took it out. Next time we had him on the show, I said, what would you like to sing, Pete? He says, I'd like to sing Waist Deep in the Muddy, Big Muddy. I said, you're our guest, Pete. And so he sang it again. This time they left it in. So what came to us was there was a constant change of values there. And as the public opinion swung both ways during the war, Vietnam War, that there was room for pressing another viewpoint.
So do you remember when that first time that he sang Waist Deep in the Big Muddy was deleted by CBS? What did they put in instead?
We have no idea. I can't have to look at my scripts and find out at that time. We always kind of, we could see it coming. Sometimes the week of the show rehearsal, during the run-through on a Wednesday for a Friday taping, the censors would be running around or broadcast standards would be crazy. So, well, you can't say this. You can't have this. We kind of knew in advance that we were going to have a problem. Sometimes we'd win, sometimes we'd lose.
Would you fight a lot?
Oh, yeah, constantly. Yeah. One time during summer show, the Glenn Campbell show, I'd play ping pong with the program practices guy, who was very good, nice guy, just following orders. And we'd play for a 2 out of 3 for a particular line or a particular attitude in the show.
That's funny.
But we look back on it now, and it was... It was a social situation that was heading. It came to culmination, of course, but it was interesting.
Tom and Dick's Mothers, recorded in 1985.